Good afternoon. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. Political corruption has been with us for a long time. Here's Richard Nixon speaking to the press corps on November 17, 1973.
In all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
And we haven't been strangers to political corruption in Massachusetts either. Massachusetts' last three House speakers were convicted of felonies. And yet committees continue to meet behind closed doors, and the budget process is often veiled in secrecy. So what is the risk for ongoing corruption, and how do we stack up against other states? On today's show, we will dig into the State Integrity Index, a five-month nationwide investigation conducted by the Center for Public Integrity, Public Radio International, and Global Integrity. It looked at everything from public access to information, transparency, lobbying, and the strength of ethics rules. Remember that you can join in this discussion by emailing us your questions at emily@wgbh.org, or you can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Emily Rooney Show. And I'm joined now on the phone by Caitlin Ginley, senior writer at the Center for Public Integrity. Caitlin Ginley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio, we are joined by Maggie Mulvihill, associate director at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, who was hired to help gather and analyze the results from Massachusetts. Maggie Mulvihill, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
So, Caitlin Ginley, I want you to talk a little bit about some of the best, least sort of corrupt, or, you know, the states with most integrity. And I wonder why those particular states ranked so well.
Right, yeah. So there were only five states that actually got a B grade on the ranking. Those states are New Jersey, Connecticut, Washington, California, and Nebraska. And New Jersey comes in at number one, and everyone's first reaction, you know, is they can't believe that. You know, that seems like a very surprising and counterintuitive place for New Jersey to fall on a ranking on anti-corruption and accountability in government. And we kind of see it as the reason, you know, why states like New Jersey did fairly well and really well on the index is, you know, these are states that have had such long histories of political scandals. Those scandals are very high profile. They're very public. People are very much aware in their state of these problems. And so it sort of creates this great environment, this great culture for ethics reform to not only be a priority, but to be passed. And so when we looked at ethics or ethics laws, and that's a huge chunk of what the index covers, that's why you're seeing states like New Jersey come in so high.
Now, we have certainly in Massachusetts had a long history of political corruption. As Maggie writes in our recent story, James Michael Curley, our famous politician, was reelected from his jail cell in 1904. So tell us, where do you put Massachusetts in this investigation?
So Massachusetts came in at 10th, was ranked 10th, tied with a couple other states, which sounds high, but also you have to look at the actual score on the grade for Massachusetts. So the score was a 74 grade of a C. So very average. There's still a lot of room for improvement. And if you look at the scorecard on the website, stateintegrity.org, you can look at your state and you can see exactly where the state failed and where the state, you know, did fairly well. So Massachusetts, for example, you look at the access to information laws, failed that section, also failed the budget process section. And so you can see and you can dig into really specifically, you know, what the laws are and what the laws are lacking. And that gives you the overall grade for each state.
Maggie Mulvihill, we've certainly seen, you know, our share of corruption or investigations in recent years. We have a clip of Senate President Therese Murray in October 2008 after state senators asked Diane Wilkerson to resign following allegations against her. Let's listen to that, and then I'm going to come back to you.
These are very serious allegations against the senator. We are all upset about the taint and shadow of doubt cast upon the Senate and its members based on the allegations of one person. I want to assure the people of the Commonwealth that we are fully cooperating with law enforcement in this ongoing investigation. I'm comfortable and confident that the integrity of the Senate and my own integrity will remain intact at the end of this ordeal. But my role as Senate President is...
Maggie, when you look at this, these results from the State Integrity Index, and you've been a reporter in Boston for a long time, how do you contextualize them?
Well, I mean, just listening to that clip right there with Therese Murray, I mean, these people in the legislature worked side by side with Diane Wilkerson for a long, long time. And what she did was so incredibly audacious and bold, and that is what a lot of our leaders have done here. And the fact that the federal government had to come in and clean up that mess with Diane Wilkerson, I think, is reflective of the fact that state government really doesn't take much action. That's happened with all three speakers. It's happened with Chuck Turner, the city councilman. I think, to put it into context, you know, I've covered Massachusetts government for 20 years. We have blinders on in some ways here. We think our state is so bad because in some ways it's really the boldness of the scandals. I mean, Sal de Macy, you know, that was a pay-to-play scheme. And I think, like Caitlin said, a lot of these scandals have led to reforms. I mean, the way the index worked, we had to score our state on whether or not we did in fact have laws on the books, which we do, financial disclosure laws, cooling off period laws when you leave state government. I mean, we have a lot of laws. Some of them work effectively, and sometimes we have these public officials to thank. They've brought it into the forefront. But I think yesterday, the St. Patrick's Day breakfast, for example, is a good indication of what is wrong here in Massachusetts. I mean, there was this hilarity expressed about Lieutenant Governor Timmy Murray's car accident that could have left someone dead. Thankfully, it didn't. We have such a true one-party government here that it doesn't serve us well. And I think a lot of the questions that we answered on the survey reflect that.
Caitlin Ginley, senior writer at the Center for Public Integrity, to pick up on a question that Maggie sort of has there in her statement, I wonder if you saw states with a more divided government, Democrats and Republicans, that they did better than states that were monolithically Democrat or Republican.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it fell sort of that clean cut, you know, looking at the makeup of the state. But, you know, I did notice when we were going over the Massachusetts scorecard and a couple other states where there is, you know, a very dominant one-party system, that sort of played into some of these problems that we were trying to capture. And that, you know, because there's one party dominating the process in the state, it leads to more of this closed-off culture. And that's something that we were measuring, and that's something that we wanted to, you know, we were including. And so that, I think, definitely plays a part in, transparent, you know, making the government as transparent as possible.
I wonder, too, if, you know, laws often are created, transparency laws are often created in reaction, as you said, to a lot of corruption. So is it possible that there are states that are really not that corrupt, but don't have very, very many good laws on the books because they maybe in the past have not had to deal with the kind of scandals that Massachusetts, New Jersey, Illinois have had to deal with?
Yeah, and I think one thing to remember about the project is that when we were measuring this, we weren't measuring actual corruption. You know, so the ranking isn't saying that, you know, New Jersey is a completely clean state and Georgia is the most corrupt state. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that New Jersey has the strongest laws and the strongest processes in place to prevent corruption. So in states where there hasn't been, you know, this history and this real, you know, real need almost for, you know, ethics laws and strong mechanisms like that on the books, you will see maybe a lower score, but what that's saying is that, you know, they don't have the processes and the procedures in place to prevent corruption should something like that come up.
I want to play you a clip from Jack Abramoff, who talked to 60 Minutes in 2011, and he sort of discusses the successful strategy that he used to ingratiate himself with political offices. And then, Maggie, I'll come to you and ask if you see this kind of thing in Massachusetts. Let's listen to it.
When we would become friendly with an office and they were important to us and the chief of staff was a competent person, I would say, or my staff would say to him or her at some point, you know, when you're done working on the Hill, we'd very much like you to consider coming to work for us. Now, the moment I said that to them, or any of our staff said that to them, that was it. We owned them. And what does that mean? Every request from our office, every request of our clients, everything that we want, they're going to do. And not only that, they're going to think of things we can't think of to do.
Maggie Mulvihill from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. You hear a one-time very prominent lobbyist convicted, served time in prison. Do you feel like that resonates with you in terms of things that you have heard about and reported on in Massachusetts?
Well, one way to answer that is that there's still so much secrecy in terms of the legislative and even the executive process. I mean, legislative accountability was not a great score for us. I mean, certainly the budget process is still very, very secret. The Massachusetts Open Records Law does not apply to the legislature or the judiciary, and the governor is exempt by a court ruling. So it's hard to tell how deep the corruption goes. I mean, one way to look at it is our laws are working because we have been able to prosecute so many people. But again, remember, the federal government has done the high-profile prosecutions largely. Maybe that's a good thing. It's indicative, at least, that we have, unlike states maybe like Maine, which scored F overall, we have more on the books here to make things less risky for corruption.
Caitlin Ginley, I wonder if you heard feedback at all when you were doing this about whether the decline of regional and local newspapers has sort of eliminated a point of oversight for states, right? You know, we have a very strong national media, but we've also seen state newspapers really either disappear or fall in terribly hard times. Is that anything you've talked about or heard people mention?
Sure. Yeah, no, that was actually a huge inspiration for the project. You know, we've are very much aware that, you know, states need to be covered, state government needs to be covered, but we have, you know, noticed this huge drop-off in the amount of coverage and, you know, the depth of coverage, and also just, you know, the number of state house reporters in the country has really, really taken a hit. And so that we wanted to sort of use this project as a way to bring that back. And so, you know, we recruited some of the best state house reporters in the country to do the reporting for us in each state. And really just give them an opportunity with this project to dig into, you know, a comprehensive look at their state government and just, you know, do some strong reporting that we haven't been able to do in past several years.
So, I mean, how can you have a last – this is one report and one day, and it may last for a while, but – If the central problem is that there are not people up at state houses anymore in force in the way that they were 40, 50 years ago, how can you possibly sort of keep tabs on what's going on in state houses and city halls, that kind of thing?
Yeah, no, it's a huge challenge. But, I mean, we're hoping that with this project, you know, people and local reporters and state newspapers and state media, you know, take the results for their state and take the project and take the data, and it's very detailed and extensive data, and really dig into their state and produce their own stories and really report out local, state-specific pieces, investigative pieces that, you know, we at the center just are not going to do, you know, very local stuff. We want to look at it more from a broad national viewpoint. But this is a great starting off point for any reporter, you know, covering their state or reporter starting to cover their state to really, you know, dig into some of the holes and some of the gaps and find out what some of those stories could be.
Maggie, you've been in local reporting for a long time. How do you see the oversight affected by the simultaneous, let's face it, decline in local and regional media? The amount of money that people can come up with to station somebody at the state house every day.
Right. I mean, that's one of the reasons we formed our center. I mean, the amount of time that it took to do this quantitative analysis, which took, 6 months at least, when two of my students, Matt Porter and Kirsten Berg, did it with me. I don't see any newsroom, short of maybe the Globe, being able to take three people off of regular coverage to devote themselves to this. And like Caitlin says, it establishes a baseline. At least we can start somewhere. This was a rigorous methodology that was used. It's the first time these laws have been quantified, which I think is a very good thing. As we say in our story, democracy dies behind closed doors. If you're not looking, then you are going to have legislators putting money in their bras in public restaurants or, you know, accosting women on park benches. We need aggressive coverage by reporters. And a lot of us who've been around a long time, I mean, I covered Tom Menino when he was a city councilor. We have an institutional history that a lot of younger people don't have. So I hope that this is a useful tool for those younger reporters.
Maggie Mulvihill, Associate Director at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, standby. Caitlin Ginley, Senior Writer at the Center for Public Integrity, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And up next, more on the State Integrity Index and what, if anything, can be done to reduce the risk of corruption in Massachusetts government. Then it's on to national politics. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to The Emily Rooney Show from 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Hello again, I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. We're talking today about political corruption, as measured by the State Integrity Index, a five-month nationwide investigation conducted by the Center for Public Integrity, Public Radio International, and Global Integrity. To see all the results, including details from each of the 330 questions that were examined, you can go to wgbhnews.org. And we also invite you to leave your own grade and to share any examples of corruption you may know about in the state. Plus, we are taking your questions at emily@wgbh.org. You can also find us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Emily Rooney Show. And joining me in the studio again are Maggie Mulvihill, co-director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. She was hired to help gather and analyze Massachusetts' result. And we are also joined now by Joan Vinaki, Boston Globe columnist. Joan, I want to cast your mind back to October of last year when Chuck Turner stood outside the courthouse and denied what he was accused of doing. Let's listen to it.
They've accused me of doing the worst thing that a public official can do. After 46 years of serving the people, I have been accused of being a cheat. I will never be innocent in the minds of the public. They have destroyed a reputation that took me 45 years to build of integrity and service to the community.
So, Joan Vinaki, when you hear Chuck Turner, former city councilor, And you hear the results of this investigation, do you think, wow, every other state must be really corrupt or that they couldn't get to the corruption or that maybe we're starting to clean things up?
A little of all of the above, I guess. But and I also think when I hear Chuck Turner, I think denial. And, you know, there no one's come out of the courtroom to date and said, yeah, I did it. Sal DeMacy was found guilty by a jury and he is still, you know, protesting his innocence and saying that, you know, what he did wasn't wrong. So, you know, there seems to be a lot of ability of people to say, you know, forget what the jury found, forget what you think happened, I'm innocent.
Maggie Mulvihill, I wonder if money in politics, and people often say this, is like water. It's just going to find a way around whatever laws you put in place. And I want to play another little clip of Jack Abramoff, because he sort of talks here about how he found a way to give people things, but to go around the laws that existed. Let's listen to it.
I was so far in it that I couldn't figure out where right and wrong was. I believe that I was among the top moral people in the business. I think most congressmen don't feel they're being bought. Most congressmen, I think, can, in their own mind, justify the system, rationalize. Yeah. And by the way, we wanted as lobbyists for them to feel that way.
And, you know, Jack Abramoff talks about understanding the laws, right? So if you can't take somebody out to dinner, then you have a party with past hors d'oeuvres and drinks, right? You figure out what the laws are, and then you figure out how to make things work. You make something a trip, a fact-finding trip, right? I wonder if you ever have that kind of skepticism about money and politics, or can laws really address the issue?
Well, we have fairly, we did score fairly high on our lobbying disclosure laws and our political financing laws. We did better than other states. But again, it often comes back to the public records law. I mean, we, for example, with the legislature, we can't know how they vote in committee on the budget. They have public hearings on the budget, but so much happens behind closed doors. We don't know who they're favoring, who they're not favoring, what they're killing, what they're not killing. I mean, even with the judiciary in Massachusetts, they're also exempt from the public records law. They make law through their court rulings. We cannot know what trips our Supreme Judicial Court justices go on, what honorariums they're accepting, who they're having dinner with. The governor is also exempt. And, Massachusetts is no different than other states or than, the federal government in the terms that one hand washes the other. But what's curious here, and Joan and I were just talking about this, is the fact that the citizenry here tolerates this secrecy. We tolerate it. And to some extent, and I'll include myself in this, the journalists tolerate it. We have not done enough to report on these issues.
Joan, why do we tolerate it?
Do I have to come up with the answer to that one? I'm not sure. I mean, you started off this program mentioning that James Michael Curley was reelected from a jail cell. And while I was not around to cover that, it does seem that, there's outrage. There's also – we also have a tendency to kind of laugh about it as well. Maggie mentioned the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. And I do think that there's kind of this cultural tolerance. It may be that people value the ideology of what they think the Democrats represent over personal ethics, because they keep on sending back Democrats who basically, dominate the legislature and sometimes the governor's office currently. So that it does seem like people are making a choice about what they think is important.
In your view, is one party rule part of the root of this problem?
I think that it is. I do. I mean, if you've got, if you've got Beacon Hill dominated by Democrats, plus they don't fear losing their jobs when they skirt the law or get caught breaking the law, yeah, one-party rule is a problem.
Let's talk about a couple ways in which Massachusetts actually did pretty well. One of them is redistricting. And I think of Barney Frank, who cited redistricting as one of his reasons for not seeking reelection. Maggie Mulvihill, how would you put redistricting in the Massachusetts context as opposed to other states? I mean, are we really trying to make strides in fair redistricting?
Well, I can say what, our experts said, people from Common Cause and the Mass Budget and Policy Center, Mass Taxpayers Foundation, they felt that this go-around was a much improved over the last go-around, that there were actually public hearings held, people could participate, those were online. So in some ways that illuminates, the reforms that can happen when a process is not good and there's some outcry and then the process is reformed. That is one of the areas that we scored high on. We scored high on political financing, lobbying, executive accountability. We did okay.
Joan, have you seen real strides recently in the last few years, be it on redistricting or in other areas in terms of weeding out political corruption, potential problems?
Well, I think we're reactive. When something really bad happens that captures the headlines and it drives the press for a while, the legislature reacts and comes up with, some sort of reform legislation that quiets everyone down for a while. If people are proactively changing their behavior, I'm not sure that's happening. In terms of redistricting, it does seem that there was a more open process, but it also seems that the people in charge of redistricting did choose who they wanted to protect more than others. For example, they worked hard to preserve Nikki Tsongas's district. So they are still picking and choosing.
Another area that we haven't talked about is the judiciary. And since I covered the courts for so long, it's something I'm familiar with. And we scored not badly on the judiciary. Many of the questions had to do, however, with whether or not we elect our judges here, which we don't. And a lot of the questions on the index had to do with campaign finance related questions. But there are some real problems with our judiciary that we point out. Number one, They're appointed for life, and they their performance evaluations are completely secret. That is a concern that nobody seems to really be that disturbed about, including the press.
But it puts us ahead of other states in the sense that we don't have voters voting on the rulings that judges are making on the bench.
We don't, we don't have the campaign finance shenanigans. But think about this: the judiciary was in charge and has been always in charge for decades of the probation department, which is one of our most, egregious scandals that we're grappling with right now and will be grappling with in the coming months. The sex abuse scandal, the judiciary took a complete pass on the sealing and resealing and resealing of these horrendous cases. And their defense was, because I wrote about it at the time, the parties want – it's the party's prerogative. If they want it secret, then that's their prerogative. But they really did – I mean, there's very, very little rigorous coverage of the judiciary in Massachusetts.
Is it a problem for Massachusetts, and this can go to either of you, that the legislature has line item budget control over the judiciary?
Well, that's always been a problem. Whenever you have to go to the legislature for your budget, you're going to be more inclined to do what they want if you want to get money for your budget. So, yeah, I mean, that is a problem. It's a historic issue. Could I just like loop back to something that you brought back in the earlier segment, because I think it's really important, the role of the press. Yes, the Boston Globe has been out there fighting, and we still do have the resources, thank goodness, to do some big investigative pieces. But if you go to the fourth floor of the State House, the old press room, I can remember back in the day when that room was filled with reporters from newspapers all over the Commonwealth, and it's virtually empty now. We have the State House News Service, which does a really good job. But I do think that the role of the press has changed so much in terms of resources and also focus. It's hard to get, some of these stories aren't really sexy, the judiciary, the budget, things like that. They don't always get eyeballs, as they like to say, and clicks. So you really need a commitment to do those stories, even if the world isn't hanging on to every word.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. I mean, is there simply a lack of interest from the public? I mean, the media is partially about reporting the stories that people want to know. And if there's no market for it, if there's no interest in it, and I just wonder if that's part of the problem, if people just become completely disengaged from state government.
Well, I guess you'd have to get, an editor in here to talk about news judgment and what you think is important. But if you go on Boston.com or BostonHerald.com or any newspaper website and you read, what's been emailed to a friend or the measurements of what's popular, I mean, it's often about, Tom Brady. It's not always about, Tom Menino.
But I think Joan and I, we've been trained, and I think it does impact every citizen. We've been trained to look at the money. And I know for my own husband and child, I'm concerned about state spending, city spending. I think we have to really teach the younger reporters how to cover that. We point out in our story that Dan Connolly sent us a bill for $55,000 for some juvenile murder records we sought. And I work with students. Students are doing a lot of the coverage up at the State House these days. And my students were a little bit intimidated by that, whereas absolutely it was outrageous and we had to question it. But those are the kind of things that happened that the press isn't following up on. And I do think people do care about how the money is spent.
Maggie Mulvihill, co-director at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, thank you so much for joining us. And Joan Vanacki, Boston Globe columnist, stand by. We're going to keep you on deck for the national segment. Remember that you can find us online at wgbh.org/Emily, or you can join the conversation. Email us at emily@wgbh.org. We'll be keeping an eye on this issue of corruption and state integrity. And up next, we will examine the other major political headlines on our radar, from the latest in the GOP presidential nominating contest to rising tensions in U.S.-Afghanistan relations. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to The Emily Rooney Show from 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.